Hello and welcome to Teen Scientist. I'm your host, Raina Malhotra, and doing our audio engineering tonight is James Ziprot. Here on Teen Scientist, I aim to bring you stories of groundbreaking innovation in the STEM disciplines entirely from a youth perspective. We feature young researchers and respected experts in their fields at the local, national, and international levels. Tonight, we're lucky to speak with our special guest, Alana Poliak. How are you doing tonight, Alana?
Hi, I'm doing good.
And that's amazing to hear. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Teen Scientist. Now, before we get started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, totally. So my name's Alana. I am 18 and I'm from Texas, but I'm going into my freshman year at Dartmouth this coming fall.
Awesome. Are you excited to get started?
Yeah, totally. You know, there are all those college feelings, like terrified and excited, but I'm sure everything will work out in the end.
And when do you move in?
I move in next week, so September 4th.
Awesome. Yeah, it's like coming up so soon, even for me. Like, I'm going in like 2 weeks, I think. So it's getting really exciting, but also nervous. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your major interests and hobbies outside of obviously your research that we will get into in a little bit?
Yeah, so I guess a little bit related to my research, but not really. I do really love anything with neurological sciences, and I've always loved the science subjects in school. My AP bio class was like 2 hours long, and even that felt short. I was also in like a couple of science fair clubs, and just sports-wise, I even used to do gymnastics, but my main other thing that I do is just a lot of children's advocacy and working with kids.
And in what ways do you do that? What are your main kind of avenues of working with kids?
So I do babysit, and I also just sometimes go to the children's hospital, and I do a lot of legislative work as well, just ensuring that children will be safe in the environments that they're in.
Amazing. And have you always been interested in science? Like, was that a field that you kind of slowly gained an interest for, or was it something that like sparked for you? How was kind of your journey into STEM?
So I actually have a sister who's 11 years older than me. And so she was going into science when I was in elementary school. So it definitely started with me like looking up to her and seeing what she was doing. But from there, I guess like the more I looked into it, I realized that there was just something like intrinsically there that the other subjects didn't really give me as much. There was just always, you know, that like chance to explore and the chance to still be creative with it. So it was just kind of like an intersection of subjects within one for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also have an older sister that I definitely looked up to. So I completely get that kind of like being inspired by the stuff that they're doing. That's like totally relatable. Was there a specific moment for you where that interest sparked, or like, is there any like early memories that you can remember from when you were younger where you feel like even as a kid, you were super into science?
Yeah, totally. I mean, going off that sister thing, I always kind of used to steal like her stethoscopes when she went out shadowing to kind of get her to pay more attention to me. But then I just kind of started playing with it. Like, I would take her textbooks and trying to read like biology textbooks for like a high schooler or like an AP class as an elementary schooler. Obviously, I didn't understand everything, but I just remember looking at the diagrams and thinking like, wow, like that is so cool. Obviously, that's on the younger end, but even when I was, like, in middle school and high school, whether it was, like, bio club or just something in English where we were writing essays about whatever we could want, and then suddenly I started writing about, like, the opioid crisis and not on the actual books, like, kind of that medical science always just interested me.
Yeah. And what kind of resources did you have access to when you were younger? Like, obviously, having a sister as a role model is a resource in itself, but was there anything else that like you definitely took advantage of even from a young age, whether that was like programs or books or certain websites? Like, what type of stuff did you make sure to use even while you were growing up?
So honestly, I was pretty lucky in the area I grew up in. Throughout school, they kind of always focused on science. And even for the kids that like maybe they didn't like science as much, they always tried to include us in that. So I didn't really go into camps or programs, but I honestly just used my teachers, like even in elementary school, as resources. I came home with lists of just like websites and YouTube videos and just kind of went on deep dives. Like the internet was really my main resource.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally get that. Honestly, it's like one of the most obvious ones. And it's like, it seems like you probably can't like get that much from it at first. But like, I think there's like an endless amount of resources online that I feel like that's like the first starting point that people should take advantage of. And before we even deep dive into your most recent research project, can you give us a little bit of an overview of any other background or research experiences that you've had prior to your most recent one?
Yeah, so prior to my current research project, I had a couple of other at-home projects. So I used to use antihistamines, which are basically allergy meds, and I tried to evaluate their protein bindings and what would be most efficient, and just kind of looking in how the medications work and if they're doing what they say they're doing or how they could be more effective. And besides that, my research beforehand honestly wasn't as serious. It was just whatever I could do at home, because my current project I've been doing for 4 years, so it's definitely been the majority of my research.
And would you say those earlier projects that you did that you kind of said were like less serious, do you still think that they like helped you in terms of like getting experience and exposing yourself to science fair? Like, is that something that you regret working on, or do you feel like it still ended up helping you in the long run?
I definitely don't regret it whatsoever. I think they were super helpful, because even if it wasn't necessarily the field that I study now or what I look into now, I kind of realized, like, looking back on it, I got a lot of those like really necessary skills that you need no matter what research project you're working on. And it also taught me a lot about like the failures. Like, if something wasn't working, instead of just throwing the whole project away, I would figure out a new procedure. And that's something that I need for any project that I'm working on. And it was especially true with my current project. So they definitely increased my success with what I was doing right now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think even a lot of people, I feel like, are hesitant to even get started in science fair if they feel like they don't have like a clear-cut vision of what they want to do in the future. But I always recommend telling people to just like get started regardless of like what you know your long-term goals are. I think my earliest projects were literally about like worms and like environmental science, and now I'm like far from that. So it's like funny to look back on, but definitely experiences that I think helped me in the long run too. Were there any challenges that you faced while transitioning from being interested in science kind of in those like middle school, elementary years, to then actively being engaged in research and like starting long-term projects and working in labs and stuff like that? Like, how did you overcome those initial obstacles of, you know, transitioning from just an interest to actually being involved in research?
Yeah, totally. So kind of like exactly what you were just saying, the hardest part sometimes was like actually getting started. I feel like once I was in it, I was in it, but kind of figuring out where to begin was the hardest part. Like, I wouldn't say that anyone completely overcomes that fear or anything, but honestly, what got me to, you know, dive right in is thinking what was the worst that could happen. Like, I knew that, you know, even with my elementary projects, like we were talking about, I was thinking back and I was like, at the time when it didn't work, it was kind of sad, but then I learned from my mistakes. So I really just got into it by saying there's nothing bad that could come out of it if it doesn't work. And if it does work, then that would be great.
Yeah, of course. And obviously now you've kind of made a long way since then, and you're working in a lab, right?
Yeah. So I'm doing a little bit of at-home research and then some in a lab as well.
So can you walk us through your journey into getting a lab position like at this age? I think a lot of times people find it daunting. And what I realize is most people have their own, you know, like different story, whether it was like cold emailing or some sort of connection or, you know, like just reaching out or just showing up. So how were you able to land a position, especially for such a long time, like you said, 4 years? How did you go about doing that? And also, how would you recommend other people do that if they're interested in also working in a lab?
So originally, I didn't even start my project in a lab whatsoever. I was actually doing it in my backyard and just like kind of DIYing everything. But kind of eventually, like after I started competing in science fairs and was showing the preliminary results, I would call them, that I had, I got the opportunity and was just offered the position, because kind of judges or even like the people walking around, a lot of those people have those connections and they want to give them. Like, they're not trying to like hoard them or hog them in any way. If they see something with promise, they really want to give them. So honestly, my biggest piece of advice for the people who want these positions is like, cold emailing is great, but also if you really put yourself out there and you go in these like science environments where all of the adults are just as excited that like the kids are here as the future of science, they're there to help you get what you want, and they're there to help you get in the labs if that's truly what you want to do. You just kind of have to prove that you want it too, and they're very much willing to help.
So it was at a science fair where you kind of got like scouted or recruited in a sense, like someone kind of found you?
Yeah, totally. That's exactly what happened. I had a couple judges that were like, oh, I have this colleague who kind of does something similar to this, or a couple of them gave me their business cards or emails, and really all I had to do was follow up, and they were like, yeah, for sure.
Honestly, yeah, that's like amazing advice. I think the big thing everyone says, and honestly, because this is what I did too, is just a lot of cold emailing. But I think like just getting started and seeing what comes from it after you are able to produce your own results is like a huge thing to do too. Now, can you actually give us a little bit of an overview of what your research project was about? We've been dancing around it a little bit, but can you give us that kind of like summary of what it is exactly that you worked on over these past 4 years?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, my project aimed to find a cure at first for multiple sclerosis, which is a neurodegenerative condition, kind of the neural cells demyelinate, which basically means their protective layer kind of goes away. But I later expanded towards also trying to find a preventative measure and also expand the process towards multiple conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. But kind of in short, I had a really long process of manipulating neoblast stem cells, and these come from an organism which are called planarian. They're kind of like a flatworm, and I use kind of a similar technology that I made myself. It's kind of something like CRISPR to manipulate the cells to kind of like fix the conditions in a way, and I used earthworms as my model organism. So the stem cells alone didn't fix everything on themselves, but with that manipulation, it was able to work as that cure and preventative measure.
And what was it that initially motivated you to explore neoblasts as a treatment for multiple sclerosis? Obviously, you've expanded since then, but I guess that was like the first step for you. Like, what even inspired you to go in that direction?
To be completely honest, I saw a study of someone in Sweden and partnered with some other European countries as well, and they used them with something related to a pharynx and found basically nothing else online about it. And I just thought, you know, like, why not try it for neurological conditions? There still isn't a lot of research online about it. And, you know, I'm one of the first to do it with the neurological conditions. And, you know, I was told it wouldn't work, but my thought process was kind of like, why not try it? Like I was saying earlier. So that's how I got started with it.
Yeah. And I love that. I mean, that's also like a huge thing that I think people can take away from your story is like, you don't need to just ignore any research done in the past and feel like you need to do something entirely unique. I admire that you like took inspiration from previous research and put your own spin on it, and we're still able to like explore a different avenue on something that was in some way researched before. I think that's like a really important thing that people can take from your journey. And can you explain the whole rationale behind using earthworms as a model organism for this study? How were their systems and like biology related to neurological disorders in a way that you could study?
So to start off, since I knew when I was starting this project, it was at home, I knew I was kind of limited on what model organisms I would use. But after some research, I learned that earthworms are actually pretty commonly used in neurological studies since their nervous systems have, let's say, around a 95% similarity, depending on what research you look at, 90 to 98% to the nervous systems that the specific conditions I was studying affect in humans. I would have never expected that, but it's super cool and, you know, definitely kind of made me confident in starting my research.
And this is kind of more of a personal question, but in working with earthworms, were you like ever squeamish or like were you grossed out by them? Because I feel like a lot of people, like when they do research, they're working with like live animals, like worms or rats too. And like my experience, like I was fully like not working with any live animals. But for you, was that something that you were like a little grossed out by, or was it like you were kind of indifferent?
No, yeah, totally. You ask anyone around me, my parents, my friends, my family, they all know I have like a deathly fear of bugs and things similar to bugs. So when I got kind of my first container of earthworms, I have like a video of me like being so scared to put my hand into it. But I guess I kind of, I wouldn't say I warmed up to it, but I got used to it eventually because, you know, they do move a lot and it's kind of disgusting at first. But I kind of just showed that in the back of my head. And, you know, now like some people call me earthworm girl and stuff. So I guess some parts worked out.
Well, good on you. Kudos for being able to overcome that fear, because honestly, I think it would take me a lot longer to get over it. Before we continue, we do need to pause for a quick break. But when we return, Alana will continue discussing her research project and also share some advice for our listening aspiring scientists. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Teen Scientist.
WDIY members have exclusive access to our weekly member ticket giveaway. That's a new drawing every week for the best events the Lehigh Valley has to offer. Concerts, festivals, film screenings, theater performances, and more. Last year, WDIY gave away over 2,000 tickets to our members. So don't miss your chance. Become a WDIY member today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit wdiy.org.
Hello and welcome back to Teen Scientists on WDIY. Tonight we have our guest Alana Poliak joining us over the phone all the way from Texas today. We were just discussing her background and early experiences with science, and now we're going to continue discussing her four-year-long research project. Now, diving right back into it, Alana, how do neoblasts compare to current stem cell treatments in terms of their effectiveness and their safety?
First and foremost, current human stem cell treatments are really beyond expensive, and although I can't really give an exact estimate since I haven't scaled it to humans yet, it can safely be said that the neoblasts are about 50 times cheaper. But in terms of effectiveness, current treatments on the market do not know where to target. To be completely transparent regarding safety, we know that the neoblasts are safe for human use because of the pharynx studies, but I'm doing more research into exact applications since my manipulation is pretty unique to my specific experimentation.
So you would say their main advantages are like targeted, like more effective and also cheaper?
Yeah, for sure.
And what were the main experimental groups in your study? Like, can you kind of walk us through how you organized it, what you like broke your variables into, and how were you able to ensure the accuracy and reliability of all of your results across these different groups?
So my study had groups for every single stage of the conditions that are applicable in humans, as well as various control groups. So basically what I did is I had drugs that mimic the conditions in the earthworms. And there were research already done by the NIH that basically told me how much I needed to dilute for what specific stage of the conditions. And then for the control groups, I had groups that were already sick in all of the different stages, groups that weren't sick, and just stuff like that to have both positive and negative controls. And then basically, I ensured they were accurate and reliable by having the multiple groups, right? But also by cross-checking my results with 4 to 5 different methods depending on the group. So I had Western blots, microscope images, qualitative actions. I had assay cell viability data. So basically, I made sure that everything correlated with each other.
You just mentioned a lot of different, you know, methods. Can you just walk through a couple of them or like give us a little bit of an overview on each of them, like how they're conducted and like how long they each take?
Yeah, for sure. So firstly, the observational data, really that's just looking at the worms and just seeing how they're acting in comparison to the controls. Cell images, basically, I just had to extract the cells with syringes, and then I just had to look at them under microscopes and then just evaluate them in that manner. The cell viability data, so for that, I used assays, and basically kind of like how I extracted the cells for the cell images, I extracted them once again and then just applied the technique for the assay to get me numbers that translate. And then Western blots, they're pretty common and loved like lab technique. Those usually took me a couple of days, and I needed machines to basically scan them for the results.
Awesome. And it sounds like you were doing a lot and there were so many different like layers to it. How were you able to kind of like familiarize yourself with all of these different techniques? Like, was this something that you were taught by the people in your lab? Was it something that you kind of like taught to yourself before going? Like, how were you able to take on such a load? And obviously this is stuff that you don't learn in school. So what were your strategies to kind of like learn about all these different techniques?
I didn't even start out with all of those techniques when I was first taking my data. I started out with pretty much just the observational data and pretty much just the cell images. But from there, for like the assays, I just did a lot of research online about how I could get quantitative data because I wanted to know what the cell viabilities would be. And, you know, quantitative data is super important to every scientific study. Qualitative data is great, but quantitative really kind of drives it home. So for that, I just taught myself through other research studies and YouTube. But the Western blots, I for sure was taught by the people in my lab. That was kind of a later stage of results that I added.
So you kind of worked your way up in a sense and kind of like added a little bit more on as time went on?
Yeah, for sure.
And can you talk a little bit about the methods that you used to determine the neoblasts were even working? Like, how were you able to figure out their efficiency and like at what levels they were working?
So basically, my main findings were that like the cell viability rates consistently plateaued above 90% for all the stages, which sounds like a lot, and it is a lot. According to like other studies online, that's pretty much the normal rate for a quote-unquote healthy animal, human, etc., including the late stages. And so that basically proves that across all of the earthworms, no matter the stage, the manipulated procedure on the stem cells I used worked, but also that like the demyelination or the degeneration, depending on the condition, was completely reversed and no longer present. Like you can just see that in the cell images. And so because of this, you could see that there were basically no more signs of the conditions in the worms.
So you kind of just touched on this. What were like the key findings about the reversal of the demyelination in your trials, and how was that in support of your hypothesis that neoblasts could be a cure for multiple sclerosis?
So kind of going off of what I just said, since there were no more signs of the conditions, when I added all of the pieces of data together, I was able to see like a specific time frame where you could really see the conditions start to reverse. And what that meant in the long term was that it was truly a cure and not just like another treatment like the ones on the market, because the conditions didn't come back. And so this really supports the hypothesis, because the conditions were no longer present and they didn't come back. So since that was present, that basically means that the neoblasts were working incomplete and entirely, and they were able to target what the current treatments can't target, because the reason why the current treatments need to continue being administered is because they can't really reverse anything, and they might be able to pause something, but they never fully stop it completely. So the neoblasts were able to keep working until it was continuously gone.
Awesome. And what are the next steps for your research, specifically with the investigation of neoblasts on other neurological conditions? Like you mentioned Alzheimer's, like what kind of directions would you take this in the future, especially regarding those other conditions?
So kind of like you said, the next steps that I already started include scaling up the process and kind of adjusting the procedure of manipulation to work towards the pathogenesis of the other conditions. So because all of the other conditions, even though they're all neurological, they all work differently in the body. So the way that I manipulate the stem cells is going to change with that, since it's not just the stem cells themselves, but it's the entire manipulation technique. And then if I could do this, it would be a more universal cure / preventative measure. So the impact could help a lot more people with a lot of other conditions.
And going into those next stages, are there any potential limitations or challenges that you anticipate you might need to address or like plan for in advance, especially in translating the findings from your earthworm models to actual human clinical applications?
I mean, you know, like despite the similarity of earthworms, they are earthworms. And as much as we can predict and say that theoretically it should work one way or another, I won't know until I actually do it and until we can see what adjustments need to be made. So I'm going to address these challenges by basically highlighting the steps in the process that can be adjusted to be more applicable for human use. So like in totality, the procedure is pretty much over 700 steps. So it's already pretty hard to replicate, but being willing to change the things up is how I made it work in the first place. So that's going to be my plan going into the human cells.
And can you share any of the challenges or obstacles that you encountered during your research journey, whether that was in recent years on this project or even before that, like getting into, you know, science fairs in general? And how were you also able to overcome those?
Yeah, for sure. So getting into science fair, I guess the biggest obstacle was kind of getting into that field, because on the outside, like science fair and ISIF, it just seems so big. It seems like something so hard to be a part of. But that obstacle I really overcame by like my friends and by everyone around me just kind of encouraging me, and I was able to go through that. But one of the biggest obstacles I had in this actual research project that a lot of people don't know about is that for the first year and a half of doing this project, it didn't work at all. I kind of knew there was something there, but couldn't figure out how to completely apply it. And it didn't seem to be attacking what I needed it to be. And so honestly, I overcame that by doing the small tweaks here and there. And I just spent like hours upon hours just adjusting every tiny thing until I could actually figure out what was wrong.
And what was it that was wrong that you had to change?
Basically, with my procedure, it wasn't being able to permeate through the blood-brain barrier like I needed it to. And with a couple other tweaks to manipulate it properly to kind of like encode it to go where it needed to go, I was able to fix that.
Awesome. And honestly, kudos to you again for like persevering for a year and a half, because I feel like that's a point where like a lot of people would kind of just turn around and pick another project, but you saw the potential. How were you able to stay motivated even when you had a project that wasn't working for like a full year and a half?
So honestly, I'm not going to lie, it was hard at first, right? Like you're putting all of this time and effort into it when you could be putting in other things. But kind of for me, I've always been kind of a bigger picture person. So I kind of just sat back a lot of the times and went, well, I already put the time and effort in it. I might as well continue to see it pay off. And I honestly could just see like if it would work, how big the potential was. And then I do have to credit like, you know, my teachers, my family, my friends, all of them were kind of pushing me to not give up as well because they saw how much it meant to me.
That's amazing. And I'm glad you had such a strong support system throughout the way. I think it's really important in a lot of people's journeys, especially not even in science fair, but just in general going throughout high school, whether it's like college applications or competitions or whatever these kids are doing. Like, I feel like it's so important to have like teachers and friends and family that are supportive of you. I now want to talk a little bit about your science fair experience. I know it was definitely a huge part of your journey and a huge part of what you committed your time to, specifically at the International Science and Engineering Fair, or ISEF, which is like the super prestigious one. We've talked about it a lot on here. First of all, what inspired you to submit your work there? And second, did you ever expect to walk out with an award?
So kind of going off the support network we were talking about, they really encouraged me to do science fair. And it seemed like kind of like a great way to meet like-minded people. I was really excited just honestly when I actually qualified for the fair, because science fair is pretty big in like my community. I definitely came in with no expectations. It's kind of a funny story, but during the award ceremony at ISEF, the categories are called alphabetically, and then first place is called last after all of the other places. So by the time that first came around, I had already like put my tennis shoes on, ready to go and congratulate my friends who did win. And then when my name was called for first, I was like beyond shocked, and I like basically ran up to the stage.
Yeah, I mean, those award ceremonies are so long. And like, I feel like by the time people do, if you do win an award, like people are so exhausted for just like sitting there. They're like surprised that like they even finally got to their category. So I understand like the experience. That's so funny. And also like going hand in hand with this, I think a big part of like science fair and just in general, like communicating your research is being able to like articulate yourself in a way that like reaches a lot of different audiences like we are today. So are there any strategies that you like to use when you are talking about your research, whether that's presenting to a judge or sharing to younger audiences like now? What types of strategies do you like to kind of use when you're talking about your project?
So I guess to start off, I usually always had a couple of key points that no matter who it was, whether it be like the extremely talented ISEF judges or a couple of middle schoolers who were just interested in the project, I would have to hit. So like more so towards the scientific community, I knew I could go more in depth about like why it works, what systems it targets, and use lots of diagrams. But I guess the kind of more general audiences, I tried to use a bit of a bigger picture approach and kind of let them guide the questions and what they wanted to hear the specifics about. Because honestly, letting like the younger audiences or the less specialized like general audiences understand it the way that they wanted to through them guiding it was probably one of the best strategies I had.
Amazing. And I completely agree with everything you said. I think you like hit all the important ones. Like you kind of just have to cater to who you're talking to and make sure that they're following along at every point that you're explaining something. And as a high school student, I kind of want to transition a little bit, zooming out. Can you talk about how you've been able to balance a project like this alongside so many other, obviously academics, but also extracurriculars and, you know, even a social life and having like a good balance between like yourself and also like everything else that you're committing yourself to?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, like not going to lie, time management is definitely a very daunting task that we all just kind of have to deal with and like adapt to it. Like you said, like everything academics and extracurriculars, but there's also that social aspect, like the family and friends that plays a role. But for me, I would really just prioritize what needed to be done and set aside the time intervals that I would stick to. So basically, it wouldn't give me a choice to procrastinate because I knew that no matter what, I would be stopping. And if it wasn't done, it wasn't done, which meant that I would have to figure out a different time. So I was also like, honestly motivated by the end goal of everything I knew that could happen. So I know we kind of touched on that. But honestly, once again, like that support network, like my friends and like the FaceTime calls or the texting, you know, more times than we could count, encouraging me, telling me what it all could do. That really plays a lot bigger of a role in time management than some people may know.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there any one piece of advice that you would give to any high school students or anyone listening who are interested in pursuing scientific research? And how would you recommend that they get started to make an impact like you have?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, although it's cliche, just do it. You know, like, it doesn't matter if other people think it won't work or if it's a waste of time, or even if you might think that yourself. The worst that could happen is, like, you learn a lot of really good lessons out of it, because, like, the best way to get started is to find the issue you truly care about. Like, it could be niche or it could be popular, but one that kind of fulfills you, because, like, even if it's a failed, where people don't show up, or the exact opposite and everything is super successful, an impact was made either way, because the failures lead to the success.
Yeah, definitely. And now I quickly want to wrap up super fast. What are your goals for the future? What can we expect you to be doing in the next few years? Do you want to keep on doing research like this? And you mentioned you're heading to Dartmouth. What are you looking to study there?
So I definitely hope to continue doing research in neurodegenerative disorders and, you know, continuing my own research. That's something I definitely never hope to give up. And I'm also planning to continue research in other potential new fields, kind of also biotech related, to kind of add on my knowledge, because all the projects will kind of help each other. And then, yeah, at Dartmouth, so I'm going to be on a pre-health track. So we'll definitely be studying and working towards that throughout my 4 years.
Awesome. Lastly, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your research if they're curious?
So anyone can definitely reach out to me via my LinkedIn. I recently restarted it because the other one crashed, but they can search up my full name, Alana Polyak, and maybe something like Dartmouth to help them out, but they can definitely connect with me on there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alana. I really appreciate you sharing your research, your story, and your experiences with us. It's so exciting to see other young students make such a huge impact, and I can't wait to see where you head in the future.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It was great being here.
Yeah, of course. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Teen Scientists Tonight. I'm Raina Malhotra, and I'll see you next time.
If you enjoyed this program, you can hear this episode and more along with our other public affairs programming at wdiy.org, on WDIY's free mobile app, on your favorite podcast platform, or live weekdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WDIY.